This week on COVID, Race and Democracy.
We got nothing. We got nothing. All we got was the opposition and killing squads in our direction. So we call for open the books, tell us the truth, show us the trail of money so that we can know what happened to our people.
Labor activists call on the AFL-CIO to open the books of their international operations to undermine labor movements on behalf of the U.S. government.
We heard that two times, three times, up to five times, the number of people who died from COVID and the pandemics that preceded it and have continued through it were from the poorest counties across this nation.
Marking the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King's Beyond Vietnam speech, activists with the Poor People's Campaign release a new report about the pandemic in the U.S. as a pandemic of the poor.
The dominant Western press and U.S. officialdom quickly portrayed the Tigrayans as victims and deployed the term Tigray genocide. That's when you're supposed to bring out the big guns. That's what justifies an intervention, the word genocide. And then a familiar regime change pattern began to emerge, the same one we saw play out in Libya and Syria.
War-torn Ethiopia is now being threatened with U.S. sanctions. We'll hear from Ann Garrison on the ground.
There are so many doubts around Ms. Lucio's case, and many, many people, not only in Texas, but around the world, are starting to take note.
Gloria Rubeck of the Texas Death Penalty Abolitionist Movement says Melissa Lucio is innocent and should not be on death row. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Akua Holt. On Friday, April 8th, a press conference was held outside the AFL-CIO in Washington, D.C. to call for opening the books of the international operations of the AFL-CIO and its collaboration with the CIA, the Agency for the International Development, and the National Endowment for Democracy, which is given $75 million this year for its Solidarity Center. The speakers called for the termination of this government funding to undermine labor movements around the world.
Everything we know about the AFL's decades of undermining labor movements on behalf of the U.S. government, we know because of the work and sacrifices of so many that are unknown to us. And the history is filled with the blood of industrial workers, farmers, land defenders, mothers and their children, working class communities. Trade unionists and grassroots people in every country facing U.S. intervention are fighting for control over their own organizations against the flood of corrupting dollars from the U.S. government. I want to acknowledge, first of all, their work, their anti-racist demands, which show us the ways we must also move in the U.S. I have to say for the record, the vast majority of people who are being scabbed on, impoverished, killed, and maimed are people of color. And the AFL and the U.S. State Department are all deeply part of this racist project. I also want to acknowledge the great sacrifice of whistleblowers, truth tellers, those within the war machine who have refused to go along with it, who have spoken out often at great risk to themselves, starting with Philip Agee, the great CIA whistleblower, who spoke himself about the corruption of the AFL trade in U.S. foreign policy in the 70s. We in Payday have campaigned internationally with refusers and whistleblowers and their families since 2003, including in the campaign to free Chelsea Manning, whose diplomatic and military intelligence leaks 12 years ago shone a light on other dark corners of what we are speaking about today. And of course, WikiLeaks journalist Julian Assange continues to be persecuted in Belmarsh prison in the UK, outrageously facing potential extradition and 175 years in prison in the US. We've been here before. In 2005, we had a press conference outside the AFL. The Global Women's Strike that I work with in 2003 wrote an open letter to AFL-CIO President Sweeney, which was published as the pamphlet, The Unions, the U.S. State Department, and Venezuela. We wrote the letter after meeting with trade unionists and community organizations in Venezuela in July 2002, only months after the attempted coup against President Chavez had been defeated by an incredible grassroots movement, spearheaded by women who had the most to lose if the Bolivarian Revolution was cut short, and with the support of military who remained loyal to Chavez in the grassroots. At that time, the trade unionists in Venezuela were calling for the arrest of the corrupt leadership of the CTV Union, especially its president, Carlos Ortega, who they accused of being CIA. Ortega played a central role in the coup by giving it the appearance of a popular uprising, endorsing a so-called general strike. In reality, it was a lockout called by the Employers Association in December and then another in April right before the coup. Ortega himself also directed the Employers March to the Presidential Palace. This is the union president leading the bosses so that the coup plotters could take power. And the workers we met with told us that the CTV had benefited and continued to benefit from the support of the AFL-CIO. They asked for solidarity and respect from North American people for our peaceful and democratic process, which represents the great majority of our people, of women, poor people, and those with the greatest need. Yet after the coup attempt, the CTV continued to get hundreds of thousands of dollars a year from the AFL Solidarity Center. And the AFL Solidarity Center went on to fund the so-called oil coup, with the CTV was called for lockouts and industrial sabotage together with the employers and the banks and the media in Venezuela in an overt effort to bring down the Chavez government with full U.S. support. Still, the CTV continued to get funding from the Solidarity Center. But the oil workers and grassroots movement in Venezuela defeated the oil coup as well. We documented this fantastic victory in a film titled The Bolivarian Revolution, Enter the Oil Workers. After that defeat of that oil coup, it led to the arrest of the head of the Employers Council and a detention order, finally, against Ortega, who then ran away and was granted asylum by Costa Rica. And so the Venezuelan trade union movement continued to appeal to the AFL to stop supporting Ortega and the CTV. But instead, in February of 2003, the Executive Council in this building behind us passed a resolution defending both Ortega and the president of the Employers Council, making it even clearer whose side they are on. And to this day, the AFL Solidarity Center continues to support and have close relationships with the CTV and former CTV officials. The CTV supports Juan Guaido, the man who, as my friend James Jordan from the Alliance for Global Justice says, declared himself president of Venezuela after a phone call with President Trump. In 2014, there was also a U.S. coup led against the first democratically elected president of Haiti, President Aristide, who, among other things, had tripled the minimum wage. Working with Haitians and others to oppose the coup, we found out that one of the NED's core groups, the International Republican Institute, funded, convened, and coordinated organizations behind the overthrow of President Aristide. And the AFL Solidarity Center was part of that operation as well. The Solidarity Center only supported a labor organization that agitated for the ousting of Aristide, while failing to act or condemn the massive persecution of grassroots Haitians that has continued to this day. It was clear to us then, as it is now, that trade unionists in the U.S. must press the AFL-CIO to stop undermining and attacking working class people in Venezuela and indeed around the world. Trade unionists need to hear what is happening and also to recognize that their own federation's collaboration with the U.S. government has also undermined its ability to defend workers here in the U.S. So we have a critical job to do. And in 2005, we joined with a number of other organizations and trade unionists around the U.S. as the Worker-to-Worker Solidarity Committee, starting with a resolution passed by the California Federation of Labor calling for an end to any defunding for Solidarity Center activities and to open its books on the past. We went to the AFL, National AFL Convention. We brought out 100 people to a rally in March in 105 degree heat in Chicago. We talked to delegates, we pressed, other people lobbied from the inside. Unfortunately, the AFL National Executive Council had brutally replaced this resolution with a resolution defending the Solidarity Center, and we could find no one willing to raise our resolution from the floor. And I end with this. We are in a very different moment now from 17 years ago. There's been an upsurge in labor organizing in the U.S. around the world. There's increased awareness that the struggle to end poverty, racism, war, and to prevent ecological devastation are interrelated, interlocking, as the Poor People's Campaign says. We're also looking forward to the AFL convention in Philadelphia this coming June. This time, we intend to win. David Hempson.
When we had the rebirth of the trade union movement in South Africa, based on black workers who were oppressed and exploited, we thought we would see the support from around the world to end the cheap labor system in South Africa, which was the fundamental base of the apartheid system. Now, what is cheap labor? Cheap labor wasn't just low wages. It meant that every black person had to carry a pass. You couldn't be in an urban area, you couldn't be in a job unless you actually had the pass and you had to register there as a labor unit. That was one side of it. The other side was the chief system. And the chiefs ruled from the rural areas. They were imposed firstly by the colonial system and then, of course, strengthened under apartheid. So the workers had no freedom in the city or on the land where they still had some land, despite most land being taken away. Those workers, migrant workers, organized in the unions, in the dock workers union, the longshoremen, and the abattoir, the meat cutters union, and so forth. We organized then unions, which then became the foundation stones for COSATU, as you mentioned, Steve, you know. But we looked internationally for support. And what did we find? Chief Buthelezi, who was someone we knew well, because he kicked out one of the people working with him, Barney Dludler, a marvelous man, stood with us during the strikes. What did Chief Buthelezi do? He got rid of Barney Dludler and humiliated him, and he kicked him out of every single position. And we found out that the workers actually, when we would go to Buthelezi and ask for assistance, he would give us none. In fact, he would humiliate workers and turn against the entire labor movement. Then what do we find? In 1982, the AFL-CIO appointed him, gave him the George Meany Award in 1982. We knew nothing of this man. He was an enemy of the labor movement, and then he was given this award, like Lech Walesa in Poland. There was nothing to show for his support for the labor movement, apart from the odd statement he would make to be polite, that he would support the trade union movement. Then what do we see? In 1985, we had the launch of COSATU, a marvelous movement which raised the hopes for freedom and socialism in South Africa. And every effort was made to build that into a mass movement which would carry the workers forward to freedom. Instead of that, Buthelezi, Chief Buthelezi, organized a labor union, so-called, actually a killing organization, with the support, now we know, of the CIA and of the security police in South Africa, and waged war against the workers, including JABU here. JABU and Lovo and the workers of BTR, that is the British Tire and Rubber Workers Union in Pietermaritzburg, we lost thousands of people. And we're still crying for them. We want to know what happened. And we want the government in South Africa to acknowledge what happened. We want to open the books there. But most of all, we want to open the books here to know where the money flowed. Where did this money go, which the workers in America were imagining were going to our unions? We got nothing.
We got nothing. All we got was the opposition and killing squads in our direction. So we call for open the books, tell us the truth, show us the trail of money so that we can know what happened to our people. We demand this, and we look forward to having good relationships with American workers. We are inspired by the organizational upsurge here. We want to see this carried forward, and we want to take it forward in South Africa and spread the good news that workers can be organized internationally in America, in South Africa, throughout the world. So we achieve the freedom which the AFL-CIO claims it represents. We want that freedom, and we also want socialism. If we can have it, we want it. We will get it.
Those were the voices of David Hempson, an organizer with the South African COSATU, and before him, Eric Jurtzen with Payday and Women's Global Strike Force, speaking in front of the AFL-CIO headquarters in Washington, D.C. on April 8th. For more information, visit the website AFL-CIO-INT.education. That's AFL-CIO-INT.education. Chocholosa by Soweto Gospel Choir. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. COVID Race and Democracy host and producer Ann Garrison is currently on the ground in war-torn Ethiopia. Pacifica host and producer Dennis Bernstein caught up with Ann on his show, Flashpoints.
Ann Garrison, are you in Ethiopia now? Where exactly are you?
Yes, I'm in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, but I've just come back from Wakite, which is story in itself, Gondar and Wakite.
Well, this is an incredibly important report, so we appreciate it. Most listeners probably know very little about Ethiopia or the war that's been going on there since November 2020. Can you give us the basics to start with?
Sure. Let's start with the fact that the U.S. has been trying to take down Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed and the Ethiopian government since at least November 2020. I'm sure they were planning it before. November 2020 was when their former puppet, the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front, commonly known as the TPLF, started the war by attacking the National Army's five northern command bases, which are in Tigray State. Then the Prime Minister reacted, as any head of state would, by sending in the National Army. But then in no time, the dominant media narrative changed to say that the war began when PM Abiy sent troops into Tigray, as though it hadn't been provoked by an insurrection within its own army by the U.S. puppets who had tyrannized Ethiopia for 27 years until 2018. Now, why is the U.S. so determined to bring down Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed? The easy answer is because he talked back. First, he won a Nobel Prize for negotiating peace in a decades-long dispute with neighboring Eritrea. And that disturbed U.S. policymakers because Eritrea is the Cuba of Africa. Despite being very poor, it has high life expectancy, a high literacy rate, a high rate of rural electrification, low infant mortality, and an egalitarian ethic. Then Ethiopia, Eritrea, and Somalia, which has another head of state that U.S. policymakers would like to get rid of, Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed, negotiated a regional cooperation agreement. And that was more independence than the U.S. could tolerate in the Horn of Africa or anywhere else, for that matter. And Ethiopia also has enormous potential, now most exemplified by the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, which just went online but isn't at full power yet. It could electrify all of Ethiopia and sell electricity to its neighbors, and neither U.S. nor Egypt want to see Ethiopia emerge as the regional powerhouse that the GERD could make possible.
Oh, man, it sounds like an old scenario. We're speaking with Ann Garrison. She's an independent journalist. She's also a contributor to the KPFA Evening News. And this has been a focus of yours, Ann, for some time. And we're glad you are on location now, and we wanted to grab you. There is pending legislation that would impose sanctions on both Ethiopia and Eritrea. Tell us about that. Tell us more. But what is the significance there?
That's very significant. The House resolution, H.R. 6600, has passed out of the House Foreign Relations Committee to the House floor and now has 9 co-sponsors, with one of its most vocal being Brad Sherman, Lockheed Martin's representative in California's 30th District. The Senate bill, SB 3199, also made its way out of committee to the Senate floor. And these propose all the usual sort of IMF and World Bank and bilateral lending strangulation in cooperation with European governments. And it's all meant to cause the Ethiopian people so much pain that they'll remove Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed from power. But one unprecedented aspect of these sanctions bills is that they would make way for the U.S. government to collaborate with big social media companies, particularly Twitter and Facebook, to limit social media discourse about Ethiopia and Eritrea on the grounds that it's hate speech and it's going to cause violence and so forth. And this is already happening. I know a number of stellar Ethiopian and Eritrean activists and sites like Horn of Africa Hub who've been kicked off Twitter.
So talk a little bit about, there are serious and profound human rights issues, but your traditional human rights groups, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, they're not quite neutral in what's going on in terms of the nature of reporting, in terms of human rights violations. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, sure. They're never very neutral that I know of. The dominant Western press and U.S. officialdom, especially USAID chiefs and interventionist extraordinaire Samantha Power, quickly portrayed the Tigrayans as victims and deployed the term Tigray genocide. That's when you're supposed to bring out the big guns. That's what justifies an intervention, the word genocide. And then a familiar regime change pattern began to emerge, the same one we saw play out in Libya and Syria. First, you get human rights reports, usually by Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International. Then the dominant state and corporate media all republish or report on the human rights reports. Then an HRW and AI report is likely to generate a dozen headlines in a few days. Then Western politicians and pundits express outrage, and then you get sanctions or maybe even an aerial bombing campaign like those in Libya and Syria. And this has all been playing out per usual here. Although HRW and Amnesty have not been shameless enough to totally fail to report TPLF abuses in Amhara and Afar regions, those are two regions that the TPLF has invaded since the war began. Now, I'm planning to go to Afar. I have been in Amhara, and I've seen a lot of suffering. There are IDP camps all up and down Highway 92 here, and I went to some of the northernmost regions where people were living in most abysmal conditions. And they all said one after another that the TPLF had taken everything they had until they finally fled for their lives. Also, with regard to the claims of HRW and Amnesty, they keep saying that the electricity's out, that the government won't restore the electricity or the banking services in Tigray. Well, we traveled up and down a corridor where nobody had any electricity unless they had a generator. And I asked why that was the case, and they said because the TPLF blew up the substation in the one northern Ethiopian town they're still controlling, Alamata. And we couldn't go there because it's still occupied by the TPLF, but we can testify that there was no electricity because there was no electricity. Without a generator, there was no plumbing. And so people had to line up. They were lining up at water tanks and streams, and it's the dry season, so there wasn't a lot of water flow. They were lining up with jerry cans. So the exact conditions that HRW and Amnesty are saying are existing in Tigray are actually existing in this region that the TPLF invaded, Amhara. And also in Afar. I haven't been to Afar yet, but these are the reports from there.
We're speaking with Ed Garrison, who has agreed to get up in the middle of the night to talk to us about Ethiopia, where she is now, and we do appreciate it. It's a story, and that you've been on for some time, a series of stories in terms of Africa and stories that we know very little about in this country, and you've made it your beat, and I'm glad that we could get you while you're on the ground. Tell us a little bit more about your trip. What are the big surprises? Anything about this trip that sort of, if you will, changes the way you think a little bit or alters your perception?
Well, it's always different seeing something on the ground. I mean, I understood this pretty well abstractly. I understand this regime change program and the sanctions and so forth, but it always affects you to see something on the ground. And in the past couple of days, we switched our plans and went to a place called Gonder because there was a breaking story. And Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International played a big role in this. Really shocking. There were professors here at the University of Gonder who were about to hold a press conference about their extensive study uncovering mass graves in the Wolkite Zone, which the TPLF annexed in 1991 and dominated and occupied then until 2018. They estimated that there might be as many as 59,000 graves of Amhara people who had resisted TPLF domination.
59,000, you said 59,000.
59,000. But then suddenly, 2 days before they held their press conference, HRW and Amnesty produced a joint report alleging war crimes, crimes against humanity, and possibly genocide against Tigrayans, and that was published as widely as HRW and Amnesty reports always are. And so it, of course, knocked anything the professors were going to announce off the headlines before they even got started. And I've seen this happen before. Something similar happened when a shocking report called the UN Mapping Report on Human Rights Abuses in the Democratic Republic of the Congo was about to come off. I don't want to get off track by going into that, but a very similar thing happened at that time. And I was at this press conference in Gonder, along with a lot of press, including Al Jazeera. Though I haven't seen Al Jazeera reported yet, and I would certainly like to, but I'd be kind of surprised. Anyway, Ambassador Dina Mufti, who's from the Ethiopian Foreign Ministry, is there. And he held a press conference after the press conference where he said that other researchers, including Tigrayans, should come and investigate for themselves. And while I was at the press conference, the two other journalists I've been traveling with were off in the field following the path that the professors followed to see what they could see in here, and they're going to be sharing. They're already sharing what they saw on Twitter, and will be doing more so in the future. And so I urge the professors to submit their work to HRW and Amnesty, because even if they ignore it or dismiss it, that should become part of the historical record. And at first they seem to wonder why I'd even expect them to have anything to do with these people. I mean, people in Ethiopia keep asking, why is Human Rights Watch doing this to us? We're a poor country. Why? But I think they might be considering, the professors might be considering submitting their work just to challenge HRW and AI to respond to it now.
That was the voice of Pacifica's Ann Garrison from Ethiopia in conversation with Dennis Bernstein, host and producer of Flashpoints.
Until the philosophy which holds one race superior and another inferior is finally and permanently discredited and abandoned. Well, everywhere is war. This your war. And until there's no longer first class nor second class citizens of any nation, until the color of a man's skin is of no more significance to the color of his eyes, I've got to say war. Until the basic human rights are equally guaranteed to all without regard to race, this your war. 'Cause until that day, the dream of lasting peace, world citizenship, and the rule of international morality will remain in but a fleeting illusion to be pursued but never attained. Well, everywhere is war. This your war. War in the east. War in the west. War up north.
Classic music by Bob Marley, War. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. Marking the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King's Beyond Vietnam speech, activists with the Poor People's Campaign released a new report about the pandemic in the U.S. as a pandemic of the poor. The campaign is organizing for their mass moral march on Washington on June 18th. We'll now hear voices from the Poor People's Campaign rally on April 4th at the Freedom Plaza in Washington, D.C.
Too many poor people are dying, and it's gone on
far too long.
And we won't be silent anymore. And we won't be silent anymore. And we won't be silent anymore.
We wanted 140 people, a minimum, to come today to dedicate Pennsylvania Avenue that we're going to fill up on June 18, 2022. We just left a report that showed that poor and low-wealth people died at a rate 5 times higher in some places, in some aspects of this pandemic, and the evidence in places was sometimes deliberately not tracked. And that if it had been tracked, there would have been all of these unnecessary deaths would have not occurred on top of what was already happening. Each of you today will represent millions of people. We will stretch out this line. We will not bunch up today. We want this line to stretch as long, so at least 10 to 15 feet apart at all times, not for COVID, but to make sure that it's long enough and we stay in Pennsylvania Avenue long enough that people know us, see us, and are very clear that June 18th, the Mass Poor People's Low Wage Workers Assembly and Moral March on Washington to the polls is not a day, but a declaration, and not an end, but a continuation. And from that day, we will intensify and embolden our agitation. But we're going to first make sure the nation sees clearly who we are. Reverend Dr. Liz Steele Harris is going to frame us up for today, and then we're going to go through a condensed version of the declaration, why we march, why we assemble, Let me ask all clergy to just raise your hand. Clergy that are out here, my brothers and sisters, we love you. Thank God for you, all impacted persons that are here who identify Boy Lowell and all advocates that are here today, because you don't know anything else to do but to stand up and fight for what's right.
What we heard in this Poor People's Pandemic Report and what we knew going into the COVID-19 pandemic is that there is no peace, there is no justice for almost half of the richest country in human history. We heard that 2 times, 3 times, up to 5 times the number of people who died from COVID and the pandemics that preceded it and have continued through it were from the poorest counties across this nation. Our nation has gotten used to death, especially when it's the death of poor and low-income people. But as we just sang out, we are not being silent anymore. Amen. We will rise together, show the pain, wail, cry out, and show our power to enact all of our demands, not just a few. From the bottom up. And so let us indeed be here to declare that we are coming and we are ready, and we're poor and we're clergy and we're advocates and we're activists and we're organizers, and we are far from silent. The stones around us and us are crying out. There is no peace. And so we are working for justice.
Amen.
All over this country and from Washington, D.C., people are preparing to come on June 18th for the Mass Poor People's and Low-Wage Workers' Assembly and Moral March on Washington and to the polls. We must assemble. Say, we must assemble.
We must assemble.
We must assemble in March here in the nation's capital to summons a moral response to the pain of 140 million poor and low-wealth people, low-wage workers, and all of us impacted by the injustices of poverty, racism, the war-based economy, ecological devastation, denial of health care, and the false moral narrative of religious nationalism. We must, say we must.
We must.
We must organize a sustained moral fusion movement that seeks to shift the moral narrative, build power, and present before the nation a redemptive third reconstruction agenda that builds from the bottom up. We must, say we must.
We must.
We must challenge the notion that what we are doing is the best we can do. Today, America has to guarantee living wages, adequate income, health care, affordable housing, quality public education, expanded voting rights, access to democracy, fair taxation, debt relief, just immigration, a climate where we can all thrive, and a world committed to peace rather than violence and war. This we declare, for this we must do. When? Today. When? Today. When? Today.
Good morning. My name is Reverend Dr. Angela Martin, and along with Rabbi Alana Suskind, we are the co-chairs of the Maryland Poor People's Campaign. And we invite you to join us as we compel the nation to mourn, feel the pain and the power of our people, and see that the path of healing and justice is possible. Join us to move this society beyond the false choices of liberal versus conservative and right versus left, and toward the essential question of our time, right versus wrong. Join us to revive and renew the heart and the soul of this democracy. Join us.
Join us.
Join us.
Join us.
Join us.
Good afternoon. I'm Liz McNichol, a chair of the D.C. Poor People's Campaign.
We assemble in March because there's nothing just about a nation that has spent $21 trillion on war, policing, surveillance, and prisons over the past 20 years amid widespread poverty and economic insecurity. Instead of fighting poverty, our nation has invested in a long-term war on the poor at home and across the world. As is always the case with war and violence, poor and low-wealth people lose the most. Today, we must come to see that war itself is an enemy of the poor everywhere.
We will fight the enemy of poverty every day. We will love those who promote poverty until they change. We will love them enough to tell them the truth. To march on them, to engage in any way, nonviolently, to change, transplant the heart of this nation.
That was the Reverend William Barber, co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, joined by other organizers, speaking April 4th, 2022 at Freedom Plaza in Northwest DC to dedicate that space for the June 18th Moral March on Washington. Before the march, they held a press conference to present the findings of their report on the pandemic in the United States, calling it a pandemic of the poor. The report, available on the campaign's website, showed that people in poor counties died at a rate up to 5 times higher than those who live in wealthier counties.
Thanks to WPFW producer Esther Iverum, host of On the Ground. Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital, airing on the Pacifica stations and its affiliates. Stylistics, people make the world go round. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. Melissa Lucio maintains her innocence as she awaits to be executed in Texas while family, friends, and activists fight for her life. Here is Gloria Ruback reporting from Houston, Texas.
I'm Gloria Ruback reporting from Houston. I'm an organizer with the Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement. Melissa Lucio is scheduled to be executed here in Texas at 6 p.m. on April 27th for a crime that never actually happened. She was wrongfully convicted and sentenced to death after her 2-year-old daughter, Mariah, died in 2007 following an accidental fall down a staircase when the family was moving homes. Melissa Lucio was immediately taken into custody by the police and aggressively, really brutally questioned. It was really like harangued for hours and hours, just 2 hours after she found out her baby didn't wake up from a nap 2 days after the fall. And they called 911. The baby was picked up and was pronounced dead at the hospital. She asserted her innocence more than 100 times when the police interrogated her. And these police included the notoriously racist Texas Rangers. Finally, about 3 o'clock in the morning, Melissa Lucio was totally exhausted. She was in shock from the loss of her child. And she agreed falsely to take some responsibility. She is a lifelong survivor of abuse, and she succumbed to the detective's demand to bring the nightmarish interrogation to an end. The abuse that Melissa Lucio suffered throughout her life, starting when her stepfather and uncle were sexually assaulting her at the age of 6, made her especially vulnerable to the police's coercive interrogation tactics. But her defense was not allowed to present any of this evidence at trial. There are so many doubts around Miss Lucio's case, and many, many people, not only in Texas, but around the world, are starting to take note. Just last month, a bipartisan group of 83 Texas House of Representatives members, spearheaded by Representative Jeff Luch, who's a Republican, and Representative Joe Moody, who's a Democrat, sent the State Board of Pardons and Governor Greg Abbott a letter asking them to stop the execution. One of the jurors on her case, a man named Johnny Galvan, wrote an op-ed piece that was published in the Houston Chronicle saying he really regretted not holding out. And since then, three other jurors had said if they had known the truth about what had really happened and the truth about Melissa's life, they would have never, ever voted for the death penalty. Groups from the Innocence Project to our rather smaller organization, people like Kim Kardashian, the state representatives, there's really a groundswell of support. Her brother, John Lucio, and his wife, Michelle, have been going from city to city in Texas, telling people about Melissa's case and why she shouldn't be executed. This weekend, they are meeting with a group of young people, all under the age of 30, who are being trained and working together to fight the death penalty, and these young people will be going to the World Coalition meeting in Berlin in November. John and Michelle Lucio are up there with them this weekend and working with them. For information about this case, go to innocenceproject.org. Melissa Lucio is the only Mexican-American or Latina woman on death row in Texas in modern history. The last Latina that was executed in Texas was actually back in the 1860s. Her name was Lupita, and she was put to death. But since executions have been modernized in the 1900s, Melissa Lucio has been the only Latina sent to death row in this state. I am Gloria Ruback reporting from Houston, Texas. I'm with the Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement. My organization, the Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement, can be found on Facebook. And you have to put the word "the" in front of Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement to find us.
The Innocence Project works to free the innocent, prevent wrongful convictions, and create fair, compassionate, and equitable systems of justice for everyone. Founded in 1992 by Barry Sheck and Peter Newfield at the Benjamin N. Cardoza School of Law at Yeshiva University, the organization is now an independent nonprofit. The district attorney, Armando Villalobos, who prosecuted Ms. Lucio's case, is now serving a 13-year federal prison sentence for bribery and extortion. Thanks to Gloria Ruback for filing this report.
And if we don't fight, if we don't resist, if we don't organize and unify and get the power to control our own lives, then we will wear the exaggerated look of captivity, the stylized look of submission, the bizarre look of suicide, the dehumanized look of fear, and the decomposed look of repression forever and ever and ever. And there it is. There it is.
That was Jean Cortez and the Fire Spitters. There it is. Ketanji Brown Jackson was born on September 14, 1970 in Washington, D.C. and raised in Miami, Florida. She is an attorney, a jurist, who has served as a federal judge on the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit since 2021. Brown attended Harvard University for college and law school, where she served as an editor of the Harvard Law Review. She began her legal career with three clerkships, including one with U.S. Supreme Court Associate Justice Stephen Breyer. Here's our newly appointed Justice of the United States Supreme Court, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson.
It has taken 232 years and 115 prior appointments for a Black woman to be selected to serve on the Supreme Court of the United States. But we've made it. We've made it, all of us, all of us. And our children are telling me that they see now, more than ever, that here in America, anything is possible. That's right. They also tell me that I'm a role model, which I take both as an opportunity and as a huge responsibility. I am feeling up to the task primarily because I know that I am not alone. I am standing on the shoulders of my own role models, generations of Americans who never had anything close to this kind of opportunity, but who got up every day and went to work, believing in the promise of America. Showing others through their determination and, yes, their perseverance that good things can be done in this great country. From my grandparents on both sides, who had only a grade school education but instilled in my parents the importance of learning, to my parents, who went to racially segregated schools growing up, and were the first in their families to have the chance to go to college. I am also ever buoyed by the leadership of generations past who helped to light the way. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Justice Thurgood Marshall, and my personal heroine, Judge Constance Baker Motley. They and so many others did the heavy lifting that made this day possible. And for all of the talk of this historic nomination and now confirmation, I think of them as the true pathbreakers. I am just the very lucky first inheritor of the dream of liberty and justice for all.
That was the voice of Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson. She received Senate confirmation to serve on the Supreme Court of the United States on April 7th, 2022, with all 50 members of the Democratic caucus and three Republicans voting in favor of the nomination to replace U.S. Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. Former Texas Congressman Attorney Craig Washington shares his thoughts about Justice Brown's historic appointment.
Through many toils and snares, she has arrived at the point where she can do justice for all of us without dividing ourselves into different groups based on color, ethnicity, origin, all of those things, even gender. Because when the Supreme Court issues an opinion, until some other opinion comes along later, it is the law of the land. This is a good day for the men, and I say that only because they were all men, who sat down with the dream and thought that an experiment in democracy would work where all people were treated equal, all people were entitled to the same privileges and immunities, and all people could live together in harmony and be about whatever God sent them here to do without trampling the rights of someone else. And we are not there, but we're headed in the right direction. I think Dr. King said the arc of the moral universe is long, and it has been long, .. But it's toward justice.
That was former Texas Congressman and State Senator Attorney Craig Washington. And that concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by executive producers of CRD, Akua Holt, Paulina Vasiliev, and Steve Zeltzer. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD and on Facebook at COVID Race and Democracy. I've been your host, Akua Holt. Thanks for listening. Before I go, I leave you with this quote. Poetry is a political act because it involves telling the truth. June Jordan. April is National Poetry Month.